KALW.
It's nice just to see little boys growing up with women as their role models and stuff now. So it's pretty awesome to see the Tides turn.
The Bay Area's newest women's soccer team is in the middle of their first season.
We found this fountain, and women's sports has a place. And as you can see by the tens of thousands of fans here, they believe it too.
A day on the field with Bay FC. Then we take a look at the budget behind the Oakland A's proposed move to Las Vegas.
It has the potential to generate another $2 or $3 billion a year.
And one baseball fan takes us down memory lane.
They won the pennant, I think, in 62. So that whole run-up with the famous song about the Giants and the Dodgers, that was all very familiar.
The past, present, and future of Bay Area sports. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Soccer is known around the world as the beautiful game. And while it may have more day-to-day popularity outside the United States, it's gaining traction here in the Bay Area, especially women's soccer. The U.S. women's national team recently welcomed Chelsea Emma Hayes as its new head coach, just in time for the Paris Olympics.
Everyone told us we couldn't. Everyone said girls can't play, nor can they fill stadiums, nor can they get paid, nor can they, like, create history for themselves. Well, guess what? Not only are we not going away, but we're going to fill them every week, because women's football now is a serious business.
Women's football, or soccer, is serious business in the Bay Area now, too. Bay FC is the latest addition to the National Women's Soccer League. The team was launched this year with one of the largest institutional investments ever made in a women's professional sports franchise. Reporter Sandra Halliday attended the inaugural home opener. It was in San Jose earlier this spring. She brings us this story about the team and its place in the Bay Area's history of women's soccer.
When I walk through the gates, the first thing that hits me is a wall of sound. 18,000 people are crowded into the open-air stadium. It's a sold-out game. Fans are sporting their white, navy, gray, and orange jerseys, hats emblazoned with an iconic B in a Gothic font. Kids have their faces painted and hold up homemade signs with messages to their favorite players. The air feels electric with anticipation. Sarah Krause came all the way from Lafayette with her family.
It's nice just to see little boys growing up with women as their role models and stuff now. So it's pretty awesome to see the Tides turn.
Bay FC is the newest team in the National Women's Soccer League. They share a stadium in Santa Clara with the men's team, the San Jose Earthquakes. And the team was founded by local soccer legends and World Cup medalists Ali Wagner, Leslie Osborne, Danielle Slayton, and Brandi Chastain. They all played for the U.S. national team. In fact, they also all played for Santa Clara University, just down the road from the stadium. With this newest venture, there's another little bit of deja vu. Two of the founding four have been part of other local attempts in the professional women's soccer space. Back in 2001, another professional women's team took the field in the South Bay. The San Jose Cyber Rays launched around the same time as the Women's United Soccer Association, the first professional women's soccer league in the U.S. Brandi Chastain was there too. Back then, she was the team's star player, made world famous only years before when she helped Team USA win the Women's World Cup.
For the second time, the United States has won the Women's World Cup, and Brandi Chastain gets the game winner on the PK.
She was so cool and composed, and she comes up and approaches it with her left foot and sends it into the netting, and no keeper in the world was going to save that kick.
But despite quality players, after only three seasons, the league, and by nature the Cyber Rays, folded because of financial difficulties. Attendance and TV ratings fell short. A few years later, Brandi Chastain and Leslie Osborne tried again in the same location with a team called FC Gold Pride. But soon after that, the team and their league folded too.
We had the best players in the world playing here since 2001. The business side of things was not ready for women's professional sports and women's soccer specifically.
When I spoke to Brandy at halftime during one of the Bay FC games this spring, she said it wasn't the players or the team that was the problem before.
There just wasn't this embrace of women in sports on the professional level. You need to be able to have media attention and awareness. You need to have sponsorship to have buy-in.
This time around, she says a lot of things have changed. One is there's broader appeal, both with the public and with the media. At the press conference after the Bay FC inaugural home game, head coach Alberto Montoya told the pack of journalists,
"The game has changed so much, and just the fact that you're all here and I'm having this conversation, the first, with the pride, I don't ever recall doing a press conference after the game."
And while previous leagues lasted just a few seasons, the current league has been around since 2012 and has staying power. But the biggest difference may be the money. Across the country, women's soccer franchise values are growing. Sponsorships and media deals are happening. Players are even referred to as product on the pitch. Here's Brandy again.
This is different. This is a business proposition. We can see how the NWSL, the last couple expansion teams that have come, Angel City, San Diego, Utah, and now San Diego team, which was bought in for I think $2 to $3 million, just sold for $120 million.
And for Bay FC, the proof is in the pudding. A global investment firm called Sixth Street Partners co-founded Bay FC and led over $125 million. It's not only the finances. The Bay Area has had and continues to have a huge impact on women's soccer nationally.
This is the richest, deepest well of talent that has gone untapped. And it's like that when they dig for oil and all of a sudden it's like Eureka. We found this fountain, and women's sports has a place. And as you can see by the tens of thousands of fans here, they believe it too.
Players from UC Berkeley and Stanford make up almost 25% of the US national team. So branding Bay FC as a Bay Area team, not just San Jose or Santa Clara, makes sense.
I would say for Ali, Danielle, Leslie, and myself, our intention has always been that we belong to the nine counties and the nine bridges, and we want to represent each and every one of them.
There's a robust social media presence and watch parties all over the Bay. I met Kira Kelly at a party in San Francisco's Richmond district.
Going to the home opener, we were able to take Caltrain down, and you could see people getting on the Caltrain all the way down with their Bay FC stuff on. And we almost went over to Oakland today just to check it out and watch the game over there.
Bay FC didn't win that game, but the trajectory is still exciting to the fans and players. Here's Dana Castellanos. She scored the historic first goal for Bay FC in the home opener.
We knew our fans were going to be the best in the league, and they showed today they were right there with us, even in the tough moments, and we are very, very honored to play for them and to try to make them happy.
In Santa Clara, I'm Sandra Halliday for Cross Currents.
Three players from Bay FC are in Paris right now to represent their countries in the 2024 Olympic Games. That's Lizzie-Anne Prue for Canada, Rachel Kunda-Nanji for Zambia, and Asisat Oshala for Nigeria. You can catch the next Bay FC home game tomorrow evening. We'll have a link to the details at klw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. The Oakland A's are more than just a baseball team. They're also part of an economic ecosystem. And the proposed move to Las Vegas is meant to bring Nevada some serious cash. But is it a good bet? We'll discuss in the next episode of Foul Ball. Here's host Suni Khalid.
The last place A's went on the road to Southern California last weekend to play four games against the Angels in Anaheim. Friday night, the A's fell behind in the early innings to the Angels before the Oakland bats heated up. Once again, it was designated hitter Brett Rooker going yard.
Oakland down by a pair.
Pitch to Rooker, swung on towards center field. That ball carrying back and out. Brett Rooker bringing the big fly in the right moment. All tied up at four.
As Brett Rooker does it again. A rocket to center. It's number 25 with Blade aboard, and we start all over. It's Oakland 4 and the Angels 4.
Rooker's 25th home run of the year drew the A's even with L.A. in the top of the sixth inning. And with two runners on base, catcher Seth Brown, who had homered earlier, came to the plate.
Hit game.
Swing and a liner. It's a foul ball. Oh, my goodness. It seemed like it caught the stripe as Brian Walsh turned and looked and said foul ball. And the A's, because it's past the umpire, have a chance to potentially use replay here.
If you're right, the question is, where do you place the runners in that situation?
Yeah, do you give Langoliers home, which you should? Everybody on the A's bench was yelling that should have been called a fair ball.
After the review, the call on the field is overturned. It was a fair ball. One run will score, and the runners will be placed at first and third.
Relief pitcher Lucas Erceg took the mound for Oakland in the ninth inning and closed out the Angels for his third save of the season.
That's on the ground. Zach Geloff will go over to first, and the Oakland A's have a winning month of July. Back-to-back wins here in Anaheim and one excited clubhouse.
But once more, the A's made even more news off the field. In preparation for the team's announced move to Sacramento next season, sources said that the franchise was planning to lay off 230 employees, about half of its staff, fittingly, by Halloween. This includes part-time game day staff like ticket takers and ushers, but also full-time staffers in sales, marketing, community relations, and stadium operations. In the last episode, I spoke with Jerry Eisenberg, the sports columnist emeritus with the New York Star-Ledger, who grew up rooting for the Giants when they played at New York's Polo Grounds. This week is my conversation with Roger Knoll, a professor emeritus at Stanford University, who has written extensively on the economics of sports. He says the A's move next season to Sacramento and eventually to Las Vegas in 2028 may prove to be more boondoggle than boon. I was reading the history of the Philadelphia Athletics yesterday, and it was John McGraw, who was the manager of the then New York Giants before they moved to San Francisco. Yes. He dubbed them white elephants, and that was basically the emblem that they took. They used it during their glory years, the short glory years in Philadelphia. Yeah. And when the Haas family adopted that for the A's championship teams of the 80s, I took a look at the latest of these artist conceptions for the proposed new A's stadium on the Strip in Las Vegas. And although it's not a white elephant, it looks more like a white armadillo. It seems that it's either the wrong stadium for the wrong site, which is only 9 acres. They've been discouraged from the site by the city of Las Vegas and by Clark County, but they still seem set on putting a retractable dome stadium on a 9-acre site, which brings to mind the term bandbox.
The only thing that any remotely like it is Fenway Park. And I wouldn't take that plan too seriously, because I think what they're really hoping, and this is pending, is that the state of Nevada will repeal its law that prevents gambling casinos from being inside sporting venues. And that what they really want to do is integrate casino activity into the concession areas of the stadium, thereby expanding the footprint to include the stadium, the casino that's now set to be next door. If you integrate the two into a single facility, then you do have enough room for a baseball facility, and you've integrated the gambling with the baseball. That raises a whole set of new policy issues. You know, we just experienced our first glorious experience with internet gambling in the NBA. Baseball has this long and tortured history of its relationship to the gambling industry.
The 1919 Black Sox scandal.
Exactly. And in Pete Rose, you know, the dollar signs associated with modern internet technology and gambling being combined. That's so valuable and has such great potential revenue. It has the potential to generate another $2 or $3 billion a year for Major League Baseball, pure unadulterated profit, because there's no cost associated with it. And that is blinding baseball to the obvious problems associated with having a sport get in bed with the gambling industry, but that's happening, and we're going to see that in the next 5 to 10 years.
So terms like integrity of the game make you laugh?
Yeah, well, they always had a certain strange sound to them, but yes, they're even stranger now than they used to be.
When we were talking about this before, I talked with a couple of the county commissioners, my mentor, Jerry Eisenberg, and he just said, the A's have come into town and they're basically taken as a joke by the local government officials. And the projections that they have based the funding on are that they would have capacity crowds. They would sell out every game for 5 years in a row in this 30,000 seat stadium. And there are no major league teams, I guess maybe outside of the Red Sox, who are able to do that.
That's correct. I mean, it's hard to say whether it's just excessive exuberance and optimism or downright overstatement. I don't know the answer to that. I do think that based on the conversations I had with people during the debate about the Raiders move and Allegiant Stadium, there is an element of the Las Vegas community that tends to be extremely optimistic about their view of the potential of sports in Vegas. So the Raiders may have known that their financial plans were excessively rosy, but they were playing to an audience that wanted to hear it. And I think maybe the same thing is going on with the A's, that there's a certain audience in Vegas associated with the gambling casinos, the three companies that own all the casinos in Vegas, basically, that some of the executives in those companies have this extreme rose-colored view of the potential future of sports there. And so they buy these arguments, even though they have very little evidentiary basis, and they're almost certainly excessively optimistic. Well, that's what I think is going on. You sort of have to be a con man to get conned, is what I'm saying.
Well, speaking of con man, A's owner John Fisher has always seemingly been in search of the proverbial pot of gold. I don't know how you find a pot of gold in Sacramento on the way to Las Vegas, but it would seem that they are drawing a major league low of 6,000 fans a game, with, I guess, the real possibility that it will sink even lower than that before the end of the year. They're going to be moving into a 10,000 seat stadium, which could be expanded to 14,000. But of course, you have to build new clubhouses to accommodate the major league, so it may not even be 14,000. There really is no guarantee that they're even going to sell out a 10,000 seat stadium in Sacramento.
I agree with that. It's what you have to think of this as: the current way baseball is run makes it possible to field a really bad team and live off of revenue sharing, live off of the national broadcasting contract plus your share of the local revenues of all the other teams. And that's what the A's are doing. The last time this was done was Montreal, remember, about 20 years ago. When the last year they played in Montreal, they fielded a high school team and absolute minimum salaries and just live off the revenue sharing. That's what the A's are doing. So I don't think they care very much whether they play in Oakland or Sacramento, or maybe there's a nice high school ball field in Winnemucca that can seat 500 people. That's okay if what you're doing is living off of revenue sharing and paying the absolute minimum you can possibly pay to your players, which is, I think, the strategy. And put another spin on it, if I had a budget of $45 million for a baseball team and I had to pick somebody to manage how to spend that budget, I'd hire Billy Bean. He's the best there is at it.
Well, Dave Cavill is no Billy Bean.
That's true. He doesn't even believe he is.
That's Roger Knoll, professor emeritus at Stanford University, who's written extensively on the economics of sports. He spoke with KLW News editor Sunni Khalid. You can find the rest of Sunni's Foul Ball series at klw.org/foulball. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. There's a lot left to figure out with the Oakland A's relocation, but it's not the first time a Major League Baseball team in the Bay Area has moved to a new stadium. Before moving to their current Oracle Park home at the turn of the century, the Giants used to play in the Hunters Point area of San Francisco at the now torn-down Candlestick Park for nearly 30 years. Today we'll hear from someone who remembers riding the bus to watch the Giants play at their former home back in the 60s. She shares her story in this segment from our series, Candlestick Memories.
I had a friend whose dad owned a business, so he had season tickets in the front row, just past first base. She would invite me to the day games when her parents were working, and we'd take the bus up to Candlestick, which was a pretty quick ride from Burlingame. Those were the days when they were on the run-up to the pennant that we got to go a lot. We went a lot in the summertime. They won the pennant, I think, in 62. And so that whole run-up with the famous song about the Giants and the Dodgers that Danny Kaye sang, that was all very familiar. Tom Haller, Stu Miller. Da 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 da.
Cepeda runs to field the ball. So does Hiller. So does Miller. Miller hollers Hiller.
Hiller hollers Miller.
Haller hollers Hiller. Points to Miller with his
and
fist.
And then he incorporated the names of every Dodger and Giant.
Orlando Cepeda.
And he had these little phrases of somebody batting and somebody hitting and somebody hitting a fly or being out.
With a wham, bam, he hit a grand slam in the very first inning. But
and then he would talk about the person who fielded it and what they did and how they threw it.
Then fairly hits into a double play.
And then part of it, Leo DeRocher, Leo DeRocher, starts to wiggle and to twitch.
A signal? No, an itch.
Everybody knew that song then in San Francisco and L.A. It was quite the song. It was a big hit.
The catcher throws right from the solar plexus. At the bag, he beats the tag, that mighty little waif. And umpire Conlon cries, "You're out!" Out?
That story was produced by Ted Muldoon and Ray Sue Sussman, and it first aired in 2014 as part of our series, Candlestick Memories.
Out in the stands, O'Malley grins, attendance 50,000.
Tune in Monday morning at 11. We'll hear about the potential impact and arc of infection of the new COVID variant, FLIRT.
We know that COVID continues to evolve, and sometimes by chance, some of these variants rise to the top of the charts, and that's what's happening now.
A conversation with Dr. Peter Chin Hong, Monday morning at 11. Thank you. Now, before we go, here's some music from a local band. This is Oakland's Fake Fruit. They'll be playing in San Francisco at Stern Grove this Sunday. Today's Cross Currents team includes Arun Nair, Afton Okwu, Julia Haney, Cherie Bishop, James Rollins, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tentz, Shireen Adel, Marissa Ortega Welch, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Good time on your sympathy tour. Hope you found everything that-